Finance Division to order for Thursday, January 17th. The agenda today is to continue with budget overviews from agencies. We're going to start with the Minnesota Department of Health and move into the health licensing boards. Just a note of introduction, I announced it at the beginning of yesterday's meeting and at the end of yesterday's meeting, and still word is trickling out, I guess. Senator Brown made it, and Senator Franzen and Senator Eakin, I guess, were over in 107. So I'll just say again, we are reserved room 107. Because we're double booked in 123 between the Health and Human Service Finance Division and the broader Finance Committee. And early in the session, 123, this room does work better for HHS and the audiences we often attract. And so early in the session, Finance Committee usually doesn't meet. So when they're not meeting and there is not a conflict, we will be here in 123. If finance is meeting concurrently, we put 107 on the calendar to reserve a room to make sure that the Senate sergeants do not allow somebody else in there so that we don't find ourselves homeless on a day when finance is actually meeting. This is what we've done in the Senate for a very long time, and sincere apologies for folks who didn't make it to yesterday's hearing because of that. Basically, if there's a committee scheduled, And there is any confusion, 107 and 123 aren't too far away. Check both, and we should be in one. And bear with us as we, yeah. And the notice will be proper, unless very last minute, finance might schedule things after the notice has been sent out, and we'll be in one of these two rooms. And that is an issue we've dealt with in the past as well as we can, and we'll try to make things broadly understood as we move forward. So with that, invite the Department of Health up. It looks like Commissioner Ed Ellinger is here, and I think you'll be joined by Dave Greenman, the budget director at MDH, as they work through this. So welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Senator Lurie, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger. I'm the Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health. And Dave Greenman, as you said, our budget director, is here. I'm going to offer a few kind of opening remarks before turning it over to Mr. Greenman to kind of walk through some of the budget information. As you're well aware, Minnesota Department of Health is one of the agencies within state government that has been included in the both the federal and state constitution, actually, public health, to be available to protect and improve the health of citizens in this state. And that is our mission, to protect and maintain and improve the health. And we're not part of the direct delivery of medical care, but medical care is part of what we take a look at to make sure that it is providing what is needed. But most of what we do are those three dot points that I mentioned, that we look at health protection, health improvement, and then we look at healthcare reform as the three major things that we do. We want to make sure that we provide the things that protect the health. We really look at vaccinations. We look at control of infectious diseases. We look at safe food and clean drinking water. We look at the maternal and child health issues affecting families in our state. We look at fluoridation of drinking water. These are the health protection things that we really focus on, because we want to maintain the health, first of all, of people in this state. And then we also look at how things we do to improve health. And I'll have a slide a little bit later that puts these things in context. Health improvement, we look at our statewide health improvement program that really tries to prevent chronic diseases, or if people do have chronic diseases like diabetes or heart disease, how to maintain their health, how to deal with the chronic issues that they have. We really also look at access to tobacco, trying to reduce access to tobacco and tobacco use. So we really are really focusing on trying to improve health with physical activity, with policy, system, and environmental change at the local level that help people make healthy choices. And we want those healthy choices to be the easy choice. And also, as part of that, we know that our healthcare delivery system, the medical care system, is a huge part of what goes on in this state. It takes It absorbs about 95% of our overall health and human services budget. So we do try to oversee what's going on with the health care system and really look at it, how best can we use it to actually improve health and not just treat illness and disease. We look at ways to do preventive services within the medical care system, but also how can we link the medical care and integrate it with public health services and social services, where we have seen that it really makes the biggest difference. If you can have a good balance between medical care, public health, and social service, you really have a much greater impact. And so we've really been looking at how to invest in primary care as one of the ways that's the place where you can best do it. And also it's a place where we can do that integration. And also primary care is a way we can address some of the disparities in our state, particularly the geographic disparities that are a huge part of what's causing us, that's keeping us from being that a healthier state than what we could eventually be. The next slide shows that we have our services throughout the state. We do have a statewide reach as a state agency. We have eight district offices, one of them in the metro area, in addition to our main offices here at the Golden Rule Building and at the Freeman Building here on the Capitol complex. We have over 1,200 staff throughout the state. And you'd be surprised to see the kinds of professionals that we have. Yes, we have physicians, and we have nurses, and nutritionists, and epidemiologists, but we have toxicologists, and veterinarians, and mortuary science specialists, and health educators, a whole variety of specialists. When you think about health, health is not just clinical care. It is really eating healthy, physical activity, toxic substances in the environment, clean water, safe drinking water, clean food, safe food. So we do that throughout the state through our district offices. And the next slide comes back to what I was talking about with the, which says, how do we do the health improvement and the health protection? And this is a slide that shows increasing longevity, the length of life expectancy for people in the United States over the last 100 years. And in the last 100 years, our life expectancy in this country has increased by 30 years. But 25 of those years have really been increased because of public health activities, not because of medical care. Medical care really only influences about 10% of our overall health. The other 90% is done by behaviors, because of the environment, because of social conditions, because of genetics. And so yet about 95% of our dollars in healthcare actually go into the medical care piece. So I want to point out the fact that the importance of what we do as a health department. And you can see this line of increasing longevity in the first 50 years, kind of a jagged line, because most of the diseases that were killing people at that time were influencing longevity were infectious diseases, bad food, bad water, infectious diseases. And you can see the big dip down there in 1918 was the flu epidemic, which is a good reminder. Still, there's still time to get your flu shot if you haven't gotten your flu shot, because we're in the midst of a pretty significant flu outbreak right now. But you can see the jagged line because infectious diseases you can't predict, and in the latter half of the century the line levels out a little bit. That's because we're dealing with chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Because in the middle, because of the work of health departments throughout the country and the Minnesota Department of Health here, in that first 50 years we dealt with basically infectious diseases, bad food, bad water, unhealthy food, unsafe water. And we really focused on the health protection activities. And those are the things that are part of our health protection mission. The issue that we're going to be making in all of our presentations is that we need to maintain those health protection activities because the risk is always there for a return of infectious diseases. For if we don't do monitoring of food and water, that there's always the potential that our food and water supply could be contaminated. So we need to maintain those health protection activities. But we also have to start looking at the last half, where we have focused more on heart disease and cancer and stroke that have become the leading causes of death. And that's where now we need to have a new approach to that. That's why our SHIP program, which really focuses on tobacco use, physical activity, nutrition, really deals with the new diseases of the latter part of the 20th century and now the 21st century, where these approaches of changing policies, getting good food, increasing exercise are the new polio vaccines of the 21st century. And so that's why we have to have that balance between the health protection and the health improvement. And during the course of all of that, we really need to focus on the look at our healthcare system and how it relates to that. Next slide shows that our argument is going to be that we really need to invest in a more broad fashion. We need to really have a balanced investment in treatment and prevention. This slide shows the costs of healthcare projected over the next 25 years. The red line is if you just did universal access to medical care. You gave everybody insurance, 100% of people had access to medical care. And this is what would happen to the costs. And you could see that the red line, the costs will go up. And certainly one of the things that we've always argued, you needed to add prevention services. And the Affordable Care Act says you have to add prevention services to your clinical care. And that blue line shows that if you give everybody access to medical care and you add prevention services, which is a good thing because it does help save lives, you can see what the costs will do. And the blue line shows the costs rising fairly significantly. The green line says everybody has access to medical care. All of the medical care includes prevention services. And you do the public health services, the community-oriented public health services, the things focusing on getting people access to safe and healthy food, increasing physical activity, reducing smoking, reducing unsafe alcohol use, you can see that what happens with the cost. Yes, there's initially some cost increase as you implement these things, but then in the long term, the costs go down. The only way we're going to be able to bend the cost curve in this country is really by investing in prevention. Yes, my goal is that we have the best medical care system in the world, which I think we do in Minnesota, but we want very few people to have to use it. And that's where you have the prevention piece. That's where the things like our SHIP program and our management of chronic diseases and our focus on reducing tobacco use and reducing unsafe alcohol use really comes into play. So this is the argument that we play. And as the last, go ahead.
Senator Bunsen has a question, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Ellinger, so then you're advocating for universal health care?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bunsen.
Ellinger.
Well, I believe universal access to health care has been shown that to be an effective way of both improving health and reducing costs, because the people who don't have access to insurance have higher costs, have less healthy behaviors, and use more expensive medical care. So I would certainly be an advocate for universal access to medical care.
You know, I actually, as I look at this, one line that isn't on here is if we did nothing. You know, I mean, so the baseline is if you give everybody coverage, which today they don't have, which is doing something different than what we do today. I'm wondering if that fourth line is available if we just allowed today's medical system to continue as it were.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we did nothing, that is what has prompted over the last 30, 40 years to look at health reform, because we have not been able to get universal access to care. We've not been able to do preventive services, and we've not adequately funded our public health system. And what we've seen is a continually increasing cost of medical care in our society. When I graduated from medical school 40 years ago, the amount of money going into our healthcare system was about 7%. It is now up to 18% of overall GDP. And back in 1972, when I came into medical school, our longevity, our infant mortality rate, all of our health statistics were very favorable compared to other countries in the world. Now we've been dropping in terms of status. Our longevity is not as good as many other countries. It is basically if we would do nothing, we would continue on that trend of costs going up and our overall health compared to the rest of the world going down. So that those data are available from what we've been seeing over the last 40 years. The last slide that I want to have before turning it over to Mr. Greenman is just reminding you what public health is. You know, public health is not just governmental public health. It is a whole lot of things working collaboratively. That's why we have lots of partners, and you'll see that in our budget presentation, that we have partners throughout the state. We partner with the federal agencies and national organizations. We partner with the medical community. We partner with local public health. We partner with voluntary agencies, because public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. That's why I also argue that when agencies of the state government, transportation, housing, education, corrections, come forward with their proposals, they should always be concerned about what they're doing, how it impacts health. Housing impacts health, for sure. Transportation, we have a good collaboration with the Department of Transportation, Department of Public Safety on motor vehicle crashes. We've been able to reduce those. That impacts public health. Certainly education impacts health. That's why we partner with as many agencies, with as many organizations as possible, because if we do things collaboratively with you as our partners, as policymakers, we can actually make Minnesota a healthier state. We need good policies that really balance treatment and prevention. We need policies that allow systems to develop, that help improve our environment, so that collectively we can ensure the conditions in which people can be healthy. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Greenman to go through our budget presentation and be available for questions when it comes to that time.
Thank you, Mr. Ellinger. Dave Greenman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and let's get started on the pie charts.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. I wanted to start in terms of our budget overview with sort of the broad picture. It starts on slide 7. Just sort of looking at what revenue sources we use at the Department of Health. As you can see, by far our biggest source of revenue is federal funding. In fact, the pie chart actually understates the actual amount that we get, or the percentage of federal funds we get, because a portion of the MERC funds we get, about half of that MERC funding is federal funds, and about a portion of the special revenue funds, the 14%, are also from federal sources. So when you add those up, it's closer to about 60% federal funded. I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the specific funds that members may not be that familiar with. The state government special revenue fund let me step back. The legislature's directed the Department of Health to do a number of public health activities related to regulating providers, regulating healthcare facilities, and other service providers, and also to delivering services. And they've directed the department to set fee, or to they've set fees and directed the department to pay for those services by collecting fees on the regulated groups. And the funds, or the revenue from those fees, goes into the state government special revenue fund. And the legislature allocates funding from the state government special revenue fund to the department to pay for the cost of doing those activities or those services. And we have the Department of Health currently has 32 fee programs, and the revenue from those programs generates about $45 million a year in fee revenue. By law, each of the fee programs that we have has to balance out. In other words, the fee revenue we generate has to roughly balance over a period of time the cost of providing the services. The MERC fund is the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund. We allocate funding using a formula and statute to clinical providers, mainly hospitals, that do training of medical students. And about $44 million a year goes out in general through this general formula. There's some other additional funds that go out to specific institutions like the University of Minnesota and Hennepin County as well. The special revenue fund is a bit of a hybrid. It's it includes funds that we collect when we provide public health services through contracts with either the federal government, local governments, or private entities. We have the authority under statute to contract out to do public health services, and when we collect revenues from that, those get deposited into the special revenue fund. It also holds other internal funds that we collect through the department. And as you can see, our base budget is about $1,034 million in fiscal years 14 and 15.
Mr. Greenman, the TANF funds on there are also federal, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes.
Yep. Yep.
In terms of how we spend our funds, about two-thirds of the funds we receive go out in the form of grants to local governments, mainly county community health boards, and also to nonprofit entities that we contract with to deliver services. About 19% is for payroll, and about 15% are for other operating expenses. These are mainly, this is mainly rent and the cost of IT services. We're pretty heavy users of IT services at the department. We have currently, as the commissioner said, about 1,264 FTEs, and about 10%, a little less than 11% of those FTEs are funded through the general fund. The largest source of funding for our FTEs is federal funds. The next slide just sort of shows how our funding sources have changed over time. I thought this might be somewhat interesting to look at. As you can see, since the fiscal year 2002-03 biennium, our funding from our revenue from the general fund, the healthcare access fund, and Merck have all gone down. Merck has gone down most significantly, and that's due to just legislative changes that have reduced Merck funding.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your chart here, it's 10-11, then it goes to 14-15. Mm-hmm. Is 12-13 just not in yet?
It isn't. Mr. Odd. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, we'd be happy to provide you with that information.
It's
I couldn't fit all the columns into the table, but I'd be happy to provide that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
And the as you can see, our reliance on federal funds has gone up quite a bit. There's one spike in the healthcare access fund in fiscal years 10 and 11, and that represents the SHIP funding. There's no funding in the base for SHIP, so it goes back down in 14 and 15. If there's no questions, I'll move on. One of our, as it's become clear, one of our major sources of funding is federal, and I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about the importance of the federal funding to the agency and how we spend those funds. The largest source for the upcoming biennium is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's our WIC program. We serve about 130,000 families or people a month through the WIC program, and these funds all go out to the county health boards or community health boards, and they distribute those funds in the form of vouchers for people to get nutrition services and also for training and education. The second largest source of federal funds is the Centers for Disease Control. They pay for programs that address specific types of conditions like cancer, diabetes, asthma, arthritis, stroke. They also provide funding for tobacco cessation and a variety of other things. The CDC is an important part of the operating budget for the department as well. A number of our staff are funded through the CDC. The next source is the Health Resources and Services Administration. This is an agency within the Department of Health and Human Services on the federal level. These funds are used to related to healthcare delivery services. They fund things like the rural grants to support rural healthcare system. Grants to address workforce shortages. They also fund efforts to increase the capacity of our health system to respond to public health emergencies when those occur. So they provide some funding to our Office of Emergency Preparedness as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, bounce off of Senator Kiffmeyer's question, I wish there was a percentage of how these funds have gone up or down over the years. We're just seeing 14 and 15 figures. Would like to know what the past figures have been, if it's been an increase. That's my first question is I'd like to know where they're at. Are they increasing, decreasing? And have they met their obligations? Have the feds met their obligations? And do they say they're going to give this amount and then – you know, like special education, we never seem to get our mm-hmm. our full share when it comes to the Fed funds. And so I'd like to know if we're receiving our equal share.
the history of it is something I'd like to see too. I think to Senator Kiffmeyer's question, I mean, on the last slide, you know, they just gave every other biennium to try to give mm-hmm. us a broader view to give us some points on the graph. So I mean, we can fill in those blanks. But another question aside from the past is, I know that we, you know, made it into the new year at the federal level, but the security of those fundings into the future is you know, something I'd like to get your thoughts on before we get off of this federal topic. So maybe a response regarding the history of the levels and how they've fluctuated, and then just also any insights you might have into how we're feeling about the future of funding from the feds.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, in terms of these, one thing I should point out in terms of these funding sources, a portion of the funds are formula-based. In other words, we automatically get the funds as a result of some sort of formula like our population or our number of people in poverty. That would be things like our maternal and child health block grant. And a portion of them are also just competitive grants that we've received over time. So this just for your own sake, this is a kind of a background on those two types of things. The next source of funding is Administration for Children and Families, and this is a somewhat smaller amount. These funds are used mainly for early childhood home visiting services, and they also fund some grants to eliminate or reduce health disparities. And finally, the Environmental Protection Agency is one of our funders. They provide us with about $20 million over the biennium, and that's obviously for our environmental health services. We do a lot of water quality issues. We deal with lead, asthma, and asbestos, indoor air quality things. So that's what that's mainly for. A number of our sections in the department are particularly relying on federal funds for operating. The largest is our Office of Emergency Preparedness. 99% of their funding is federal. This is the area that responds when we have a public health emergency. They were up in Duluth this last year. They provide responses often when there's a weather emergency. Lately, that's what's been the case.
Duluth, Carlton, and Pine Counties, and Aiken, and surrounding areas.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's right. I was getting to that. Let's see. They also work with a healthcare system to provide training and acquire and store supplies for responding to emergencies. Our community and family health section gets about 4/5 of its funding from the feds. These are the folks who administer the WIC program. That's primarily most of that funding. They also do early childhood home visiting, and they also administer the pre-pregnancy family planning program as well. The health promoting and chronic disease area, that's the area that focuses on specific types of health services or health conditions like cancer. They do cancer screening for low-income women through this program as well. Our infectious disease epidemiology prevention and control area, kind of a mouthful. But they do quite a bit of work in terms of investigating infectious disease outbreaks. They're the people who go out and work, have been working on the fungal meningitis issue. Our director of that area is on the radio very often talking about the flu epidemic. And that's primarily what they do. They've dealt with the swine flu at the state fair. It's those kinds of activities that they get involved in. The Office of Statewide Health Improvement is about 2/3 funded through federal grants. This is the area that operates primarily in the area of tobacco cessation and also in changes in health behaviors. These folks have operated the SHIP program. They've received some funds from the Centers for Disease Control to deal with things like nutrition, exercise, those kinds of activities to improve health behaviors. In terms of your question about federal funding, the Department of Health is pretty vulnerable to any changes in federal funds, given our reliance on those dollars. Over the years, we have seen a lot of reductions, some of them small, some of them larger, in areas like our public health lab is receiving less funding, epidemiology is getting less in the way of grants, and our lead program has seen a reduction in federal funds. They're also talking about, there's also been some discussion about additional cuts in some of the larger grants that we receive, like our preventive health grant, our preventive health block grant, which the CDC operates, that is being reviewed as a possibly eliminating that grant. That grant's been up for elimination several years, and it's been saved each time. So we don't really know what's going to happen there with that one. If we were to, if the state were to, or the, if the federal government were to go over the quote-unquote fiscal cliff, we would be looking at some pretty significant cuts in our programs. Most of our programs are not exempt from the sequestration, they call it, which would occur, the automatic spending cuts that would occur if we went over the cliff. Some of the areas that would be affected most would be our WIC program, our maternal and child health block grant. I can get you specific numbers about what those cuts would mean, or what that would mean in terms of dollars and cents. I did provide that earlier to, I think, a House committee when we were looking specifically at the January 1st drop-off date. And I think some numbers are just starting to come out now about what it would look like in terms of grant funding. I know that they were looking at about $109 billion in cuts in federal fiscal year 13 with the January 1 deadline. That's gone down. That would be, the cuts would be about $85 billion now if they were to occur March 1st. So about a 20% reduction in what we were looking at in the past. So I think, you know, roughly speaking, I would say we'd be looking at something around $25 to $22 billion in reductions for the Department of Health over the biennium.
Okay. I think the committee would appreciate some follow-up on those numbers and how they changed between the last fiscal cliff and the upcoming one, and just so that we can be engaged with our federal colleagues. And Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, if the report could also include what the actual dollars have been for the past couple of years, because it's easy to talk about cuts, but to know what the actual dollars were puts it in perspective. I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we can certainly provide
that.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman.
Next, I thought I would walk through the...
One second. Senator Sharon.
What's helpful to me besides the numbers is what that means on the ground, what the practical implications are of those cuts, what decisions you will be making. As you've looked at that, what services will Minnesotans not be getting from the Department of Health as a result of those cuts? The numbers are important, but I have to understand, as you're looking at that, their meaning.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, we can certainly get that as well. We have been looking at that, obviously, as we try to think about how we would implement those kind of cuts. We've certainly been studying that quite a bit.
Yeah. Thank you.
The next slide looks at basically how our department is laid out organizationally. This gets at how we're funded and how we budget our programs. We have four bureaus at the department, and within each of those bureaus, we have divisions. There's about, I think, the three bureaus that actually provide the direct services outside of the agency are the Health Improvement Bureau, Policy Quality and Compliance, and the Health Protection Bureau. And these budget activities within the department occur at the division level. And so I'll be walking through most of the divisions to just give you a sense of how they're funded, what they do, how they use their money. And I'll start with the first pie chart is our administrative services area. Their total base budget is $95 million for the biennium. This is the area of the department that the largest funding for this area is for building rent and our IT services. All of the funding for our IT services at the department flows through this particular bureau as a result of, I think, the 2011 legislation that created the single agency to provide IT services for the state. That's how we're spending that money, that accounts for about half of the spending in our administrative services budget. This is the area that they also cover the cost of central services like general counsel, HR, performance improvement areas in there, as well as internal audits. We also, one important aspect of what we do in the central office is we have pages and pages of federal grants that we receive, and needing to track all of those funds. They're often on different timelines. There's different rules around what kind of match we need. All those rules, we need staff to sort of keep track of all that stuff, and it's a pretty big task. And that's one of the things that area does as well. Starting with the first division that does work in the communities, this is a community and family health division. Their budget is about $396 million, most of it federal, and this is, again, the WIC program. As I said before, the WIC program, I think most people are familiar. It's a nutrition program that works with low-income women and children, provides them with nutrition as well as education. We serve about 130,000 people a month in the WIC program. The other pieces of our budget in this area are the other activities that we use these funds for. I think some of the members might be familiar with the healthcare home concept, which is something that's been discussed in healthcare reform in the past, which is where we certify clinics in the state that meet certain quality rules and deliver in terms of service delivery and quality and willingness to coordinate care for people. We certify those in this area as well, and to date we've certified about 215 healthcare homes in the state. This area also administers our pre-pregnancy family planning program, our positive alternatives programs, and our program for preventing fetal alcohol syndrome as well. The next area is health promotion and chronic disease. This is an area that works to prevent treatment conditions such as stroke, diabetes, asthma and arthritis. It works on treatment plans and also on preventive care. Some of the things this group does is they run the program that screens for breast and cervical cancer. In fiscal year 12, we screened about 17,600 women for breast and cervical cancer. They also fund the Poison Control Center, which is run out of Hennepin County Medical Center. This is our statewide program that receives phone calls from hospitals, from health plans, from parents when they're concerned about a possible poison exposure. They received about 49,600 calls last year through the Poison Control Center. And this also operates our Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System is also operated through this area as well. The next division is our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. The budget for this area is about $13 million. They primarily provide grants, and they receive funding for both a general fund appropriation and they receive TANF funds to provide grants to community-based organizations that work on reducing the gap in health status between communities of color and the white population. Their focus primarily has been on infant mortality, adult and child immunizations, diabetes, other conditions that may show up more prevalently in communities of color, working to reduce those the gap there. In 2012, they provided about 47 grants to community groups and 8 grants to tribal communities.
Senator Benson had a question, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons that Minnesota's health rankings have been dropping is because our disparities are one of the largest in the country. How long has this department, I don't know the right term, been in existence, and are we seeing a drop? Do we need to look at some accountability, or are there accountability measures in place? If you could address that briefly, I know we'll get a chance to talk about this at budget time.
Commissioner.
Chair Senator Benson, it's an Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, and I believe these grants have been around for about 10 years. And you are correct in stating that our health rankings are not improving because of the disparities that we have with an increasingly diverse population if we don't reduce the disparities. Some of the grants have been targeted at specific issues. Some have had good success in reducing the disparities where the grants are. But overall, we have not had a significant impact overall if you look at overall disparities. And so that we're really looking at how we can better target these resources and how we can integrate health disparities activities in all of what we do as a department and also at what we do across state government, because this is an issue that we've talked about at the administration level. All cabinet members are looking at what they can do to help reduce disparities in the state. So this has been a crucial piece of our efforts, and have particularly in infant mortality, has where they have targeted those resources have made a difference. Also in some of the sexually transmitted infections have made a difference. But the issue is so large that these grants can only kind of scratch the surface of what really needs to be done.
And I think that a public health approach can be very effective at combating some of the health disparities that we have struggled to try to combat. And one of the reasons cited frequently for the slippage when the nation's health rankings are produced is Minnesota's very low level of expenditure in public health activities. I believe the most current shows us at 48th in the nation in per capita spending.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We're 48th in lowest in the country for state expenditures on public health.
Yeah, which is, I think it kind of helps us get behind and try to understand some of the points that were being made earlier in the slides about the need to really move upstream and think broadly about the investments that we make and how we target them to try to address some of these critical needs and stop the slippage and focus our resources where they can be really helpful. Senator Benson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, we talked about being 48th in per capita for state spending, but when we present numbers as we go forward and are making some financial decisions, I'd appreciate a full look at what counties and cities are spending on public health services and where that puts us compared to other states in the nation, if that data is available. If we're going to try to benchmark performance and spending in our public health programs and across all agencies, we can take snapshots and statistics and figures lie and liars figure. That's kind of what we do to move our points across. And so if we can take a full picture of what's available and then decide how it can best be used, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. I would fully applaud the efforts to really get behind that. I was actually citing from the report that ranks the nation in these health rankings, and that's one of the key indicators that they say is behind that. So getting further behind that number and looking more broadly is absolutely welcomed. Senator Kiffmeyer, and I believe Senator Hayden has a question as well, but Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Ellinger, having served on Health and Human Services Finance for 4 years, we've had a variety of issues that come through us, and I have grown to appreciate even more the public health department and its standing nationally as well, and some of the good things. But I will tell you, I have a little frustration. I always believe you focus on the majors. I mean, that's where the big bucks are, you might say, or the greatest thing. But I've also seen increasingly, and this affects and maybe you can clarify if there's something like that, such as church dinners and regular folks being able to bring in food and enjoy church dinners. Parents can't bring in homemade cookies to school functions anymore. And yet I've hardly ever heard too much about people dying from a homemade cookie issues. But, it just for me, it's one of those things that it seems like the community, the sociability, those kinds of things. I know this is not a huge thing, but it's just an annoyance. And also I see the disruption in the goodwill amongst families and churches and kind of that good thing. And I've Maybe you can give some background on the justification for that, and are there statistics that show that there's harm coming from homemade cookies being brought to school?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, well, we would certainly be able to have a longer conversation about this because I know this has been an issue that has been come up. And our goal is to protect the health of people in Minnesota. And we know that people get sick from a variety of things. And food is one of the things that has can cause illness and disease. And we've had many experiences where this has happened, and so we do the best we can to protect that, because it also has it can have an impact on a lot of people and can spread very quickly. But we also try to work as best we can to allow people to be able to do what is appropriate in certain circumstances, and certainly have worked with the faith community and churches in terms of potlucks to be able to educate folks about how to do it without the severe regulation that we might have if it's a commercial kind of venture. So it's a balance between protecting the health and allowing some flexibility, and we try to be as flexible as we can within the bounds of good science and what we know is which will protect the health. But we can certainly have generate some numbers in terms of food outbreaks and foodborne disease. I don't have those right at my fingertips right now, but we could share that with you.
And we have long discussions about that every session, and we'll get to that as we move forward and look forward to seeing your analysis. But back to the minority and multicultural health, I think Senator Hayden also had a question.
Yeah, I guess my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. and Dr. Ellinger. So it wasn't – I thought Senator Kiffmeyer was going on a road, but it deviated a little bit to the foodborne illnesses and kind of how people bring. But I guess what I would like to focus on is – I think that dollars are very important to this conversation, and, you know, we kind of bandy about how much money we spend and if those dollars are, you know, make a difference. I kind of want to understand much more about the relationships, and so how do we go about our work? Because if we go about our work in a way that isn't relationship driven, especially in communities of color, then you can spend all the money in the world and you won't have the outcomes that you're looking for. And so, Dr. Ellinger, I guess I would like to get a better understanding of how your organization is looking at the way in which it works with communities of color, the relationships that it's developed with its community leaders, so that the information, though valuable and though probably timely and makes a lot of sense, actually reaches the population that is struggling. And so I guess I'd like to hear kind of how you guys think about that.
Dr. Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, it's a good point. This is not all just about dollars. I mean, dollars are important, but it is a lot about relationships, and we've actually started to change how we interface with communities. Assistant Commissioner Jean Ayers, who runs the Health Improvement Bureau, was brought on to try to change that relationship where we actually are in partnership with local communities, try to have communities engaged in the issues and have some ownership of the issues, and that we can then partner with them. This is a change. It is not us saying this is what you must do, but much more an interactive kind of thing where we have a dialogue about what needs to be done and try to craft programs to address that. This is a difficult thing when we have certain rules and regulations that we have to follow, and also a change in structure, and also just the definition of community, trying to find who the community leaders are to work with. What are the agencies that really represent the community? Who are the constituencies that were there? So we're trying to have as much dialogue as we can with communities and change our approach to be one of partnership as opposed to a funding agency only. And we'd love to work with you on trying to figure out better ways to do that.
These are really important topics. We have a couple more members that want to engage as well. You know, I have a couple of comments, too. I recall a health disparities meeting we had up on the north side. You came and presented and just told us of some of the statistics that we're running right now in Minnesota and just approaches that we need to try to take. A couple that stuck out with me was that women of color who get an abnormal breast exam, it takes twice as long to get the follow-up care as white women. These are just alarming statistics, because one of the things that we often talk about is, you know, we need access to care. And so this is one where it just struck me. I mean, these are individuals who've actually broken that access barrier, made it into our healthcare system, been seen, been found to have an abnormal exam, we know, you know, as a medical health community, that we need to respond quickly to make sure that they have the best outcomes that they can receive. And yet, our system isn't working to give them the same degree of care. Asthma in youth was the other one that struck me. I don't remember the exact statistics, but it was alarming about the number of children of color in different races, additional disparities that were sometimes as many as 10 times less likely to receive the prescription drugs that are known to be effective in combating asthma. And so, I mean, these are the ones that just really jumped out at me. I mean, we've crossed the access barrier. We've had these individuals present to our healthcare system, and we haven't figured out the tools to wrap around them. And I think Senator Hayden's comments about making sure that we have the relationships and the systems to respond appropriately when people present is just absolutely critical. So, I mean, I don't know if you want to comment on that. We have a couple of other
Senator Blurry, members of the committee, I'm really appreciative of the fact that you understand the seriousness of this. This is one of the things, the disparities in our state are really disgraceful. And the data that I presented on the north side as part of the health insurance exchange highlighted many of the things that you were talking about, and I can certainly make those data available to you. But it is a problem that we have not had a lot of success in. We've had targeted grants, as I mentioned, that haven't made a difference. But in the big picture, you know, it's a pittance. We need to change how we do things. We need to change our workforce. We need to have our workforce reflect better the populations that are being served, and we aren't able to do that. We need to look at, even in state government, we need to look at salaries that we pay, you know, to attract the kinds of people who, at high levels, who can be leaders in their communities. This is an issue that is very broad. It needs a lot of input from a lot of folks and a lot of conversation if we're going to really make a difference. And I would really value and appreciate some conversations specifically about that as how we go forward.
I appreciate your partnership in that. Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And remember yesterday I talked about the big whiteboard?
Yes, I think this another would be whiteboard. You're
another
right.
Another whiteboard. Exactly, because I think in combination with Senator Benson and Senator Hayden's comments about the relationships and not just necessarily looking at these funds in a silo, we need to look at all the funds that are available and are they working together?
Right.
What are the barriers that are preventing this group of not getting the proper care? I think, especially in this area, that it needs to be nimble because the situations, what's happening to the minorities, and we have to react fairly quickly. Otherwise, it's a quick spiral downwards. And I'm not saying necessarily more money, but looking at the barriers. And I hope, Mr. Chair, that we have the time to really take a look at this because it's all the state and the county and all the funds that are coming in. We need to really see where we're deficient, where we have adequate, what are the barriers that need to be broken down, and look at it more holistic than just always silo. We need more money in this program. Well, is it doing the job? And how can we help it do the job better?
Yes, agreed. It's a systems approach. It's not all about the dollars. And I really am committed to making sure that we do spend the time. You know, we have a few months here to get a lot of work done. It'll be more than the 2013 session that these discussions will occur in. Certainly, we need to make that clear. But absolutely, breaking down these barriers, getting behind it, trying to work together to figure out solutions, to break some of these trends that we all know are preventing Minnesota from being as good as we all want to be. And truthfully, our healthcare community, broadly speaking, understands these issues well and wants to get the healthcare reform systems and approaches that we're talking about to actually truly address some of these core issues that have been preventing real movement. And I'm really excited about the opportunity and about the really in-depth conversations as we roll forward. Senator Benson.
Well, and my request is probably going to be redundant, but I was going to ask if you were planning to specifically have a hearing on disparities, because it keeps cropping up in every conversation. And I'm so glad that you, it sounds like you're going to try to fit something in. We have a very aggressive agenda, but it will impact, while the money comes from all kinds of places, the problems spread out to all kinds of places. And so I appreciate that you're going to elevate this a little bit for us.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't talked about a hearing on disparities, but, you know, seeing the level of interest, I mean, it is something that I really have viewed as of critical importance. Senator Sharon and I will talk after this.
Right,
and Senator Sharon.
We have similar hearings going on, and one of the things I'm thinking about is maybe we should joint do some of these because some gets repetitive between the committees, and some members are on both committees. So maybe this is one that's emerging among others that we would pull the committees together to hear, because there are members on the policy committee that are not here, and there are members here that are not on the policy committee. So this is clearly a policy conversation that establishes a policy that comes then to the committee for funding.
But I'm really excited about the fact that we got such great engagement on this particular slide, and we'll work with all members to try to make sure that we pay enough attention to these critical issues.
And the House might want to join us. You know, it's just that big of an issue. So
the staff is going, oh, no, another of those. Those are really hard to put together.
Yeah.
There's like 40 members, and, you know, the fire marshal comes over and says, you know, what are you doing? Everybody got to sit down. So, we understand that we ask a lot of our departments in terms of somewhat duplicative and try to work with members to best utilize our committee time. This is a critical topic. Senator Sharon and I, in conjunction with Representatives Liebling and Huntley, will work on this along with our leads from the Republicans, Senator Rosen and Senator Benson. Really appreciate the in-depth conversation and really want to spend a good deal of time on this. So we will. Mr. Greenman, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next next division in the department that we'll be talking about is compliance monitoring. This is the area of the department.
Statewide Health Improvement.
Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped. Okay. The Statewide Health Improvement Office is the next one. They have a budget of about $20 million over the biennium. This is, the area that has operated the SHIP program. They also receive grants from the CDC to do actually a program very similar to SHIP, which is actually modeled after SHIP. So that's where a portion of the federal funding comes from. They provide grants to community-based organizations. In the last biennium, SHIP provided grants to 18 – or had 18 grants go out to serve about 55 communities to address various issues such as eating, unhealthy eating, physical inactivity, tobacco use and exposure, and other sort of unhealthy behaviors to look at sort of bending the curve on our health outcomes. They also provide, they focus on things like tobacco cessation as well, provide a number of grants to community-based groups to deal with tobacco cessation. I can skip to the next one then if nobody has questions. Oh, yes.
Oh, Senator Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grimmon, I actually, my Senate district has many of these grants. And this is the SHIP program, of course, was brought in 2008 in the health improvement program, or the health reform year, and was active in that. I personally am in favor of this. And this, it has shown in my district to be a wonderful opportunity for people to reach out and develop relationships with other people across counties and across different communities that they've never had that opportunity or would never have done that before unless there was some money involved. And I've actually seen some good results. However, there seems to be some division on this particular program still, and perhaps some of the program or some of the grants that have been awarded have been questionable about the results, and I think if we could really narrow this down and get this to work with the dollars that have been provided, and hopefully will be provided going forward, I think you're going to see some great results. I have out of my Senate district. So that's just for the record.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we're glad that we're doing the evaluation pieces of SHIP. And I think some of the controversy that has come up is that we take a little different approach in terms of people think about health in terms of medical care and a direct delivery of service and doing some things like complete streets where you really have set the stage for people to be able to walk and bike to school and to work is something we have to educate folks about. And it is also the evaluation of SHIP has been one, particularly in your area, actually has been an economic development piece where right. farmers have been able to maintain a market for their food that they had never had before, that the evaluation is much broader than just health. It's actually a community development and an economic development tool in many of the communities. And we will present more information about that as we get that available.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, I guess I'd like to echo Senator Rosen's comments about SHIP, not that it is perfect and that it's evolving, but I'll give you an example of something that I know that the city of Minneapolis, which SHIP funds are with you guys in partnership, we're able to do is to take MFIB recipients and take the SNAP program, what people call the food stamps, and they were able to go to the farmer's market and use their EBT card for a coin or a voucher and be able to buy fresh food from the Minneapolis farmer's market, which is a very large farmer's market. So that encompasses everything that we want. We have a lot of conversations, and we probably will have it here again if I know this legislature about, you know, what are people doing with the dollars that we give them, and are they using the dollars appropriately to feed their family and house and clothe their family? Well, this was a real opportunity for a low-income person to not have to go to a corner store or places in which they have unhealthy food, but to actually go to a fresh food market and utilize the card to buy fresh food for their family. That's just an example. I'm sure that there are examples that are even greater than that, but an example for me that I think was profound.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, this is, I think, getting back to the disparities conversation, changing the discussion. SHIP is a good model to do that because it is community-oriented, community-led. Community leadership does determine what things are done in those communities among best practices, and this is one way that we can actually address some of the disparities.
I had a similar good experience with the SHIP grants up in my communities, and it's been a real impetus for change that's been really helpful, and everybody's been engaging, and it's great. I should say we have about 15 health-related boards that are here to present, and so we should try to move through these a little quicker. I mean, I really do enjoy the, and I'm glad that we're getting engaged in the conversation with that. Senator Sharon?
I'll try to be very brief. Okay. On this subject of SHIP, for this committee in particular, the Finance Committee, this in the healthcare reform was an initiative that was even at that time underfunded in terms of what its capacity would be to change culture and behavior that is true prevention work. It's pre-victim, pre-disease. It is creating the environment for us to not move into diseases, whether they're short-term or chronic diseases. And when we're talking here about where our healthcare dollars are spent, where we can have the longest impact, it's in this area, health-wide improvement, the SHIP program, which is a prevention program. And yet, when we get into our financial discussions, this is where we take money away. And my question for the commissioner is, would you tell us, in relationship to the overall healthcare dollars that we spend, what percent is spent on prevention as opposed to chronic disease management?
And Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Senator Sharon, as I presented to the policy committee, we spend only about 5% of our overall healthcare dollar on prevention activities. And yet the behaviors that lead to chronic diseases cost about 75% of our overall costs come from those. So there's a real mismatch in prevention dollars and the amount of money that is spent on treatment.
And thank you. Just to follow up, I'm just trying to make a point that what we will see is out of the Health Policy Committee, because of my strong interest in this very specific problem of how much we're spending on prevention and chasing the caboose running the train instead of us really addressing the front end enabling systems for disease. That when it comes here, after it gets through policy committee, it comes here, it's up to this committee to talk about whether it's committed on a financial level to this kind of activity.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually written SHIP grants and administrated SHIP grant in our school district, the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools. So I've seen some great things happen, the engagement of students in the process and teachers. And unfortunately, to speak to Senator Sharon, we had a SHIP grant, but unfortunately when we applied for the second year, the funding was cut and we couldn't continue many of the programs that we had originally started or continue with our plans. So I certainly am in support of the SHIP program because I've seen it firsthand and administer the grant. Thank you.
All right.
The next division is compliance monitoring, and this is the area that primarily their role is to regulate and enforce laws related to healthcare providers. We regulate over 30 types of healthcare providers, obviously those that don't have specific boards to regulate them. We also regulate healthcare facilities. There are about 870 health and long-term care facilities that we in the state that we regulate on and enforce consumer safety rules and other rules related to the Medicare and Medicaid program. This area has a budget of about $72 million over the biennium. The largest share of that is special revenue. That's actually funding that we get through a contract to certify Medicare and to do Medicare and Medicaid certifications of facilities for those programs. And as you can see, because of the fee piece, about a quarter of that budget also comes from the state government special revenue fund through the fees they generate. The next area is our health policy area. These are the folks who do our health economics program. That's one of the more visible areas that they work on. They do the research to monitor and understand our healthcare system, to look at healthcare costs, market conditions, other aspects of our overall healthcare system. They also are quite involved working on healthcare reform issues. They've worked on a number of major federal grants lately. They work on our provider peer grouping program and also different types of healthcare delivery system issues. This area also deals with supporting rural and primary healthcare providers to address shortages and expand capacity in rural areas. The next division is environmental health. These folks, like the compliance monitoring area, do quite a bit of regulating. They deal with not necessarily even regulating as much as just making sure drinking water quality is up to par, making sure they're looking at contaminants in our well water and our drinking water. They also deal with indoor air issues. These are the folks who enforce the Clean Indoor Air Act. They look at issues related to lead. They do our lead program in the state. They also inspect restaurants or oversee the program that inspects restaurants. A number of counties do the inspections themselves, but we oversee the program for food safety. And they also respond to environmental health risks. They look at health-based guidelines in terms of contaminants in the air and in the water to make sure that they stay at safe levels. The next area is our infectious disease epidemiology prevention and control area. This is the area that detects and investigates and mitigates contagious diseases. They deal with issues related to Lyme disease, as I mentioned before, fungal meningitis, the flu. They run our vaccination program. They also run our STD programs, operate grant programs for STDs in the state. Let's see. And their budget is about $57 million, and much of their funding is through the CDC. Our public health lab is the next area. Its budget is $35 million. They do a number of tests related to both infectious disease, possible disease epidemics. They also look at the quality of our water and our air. They do tests on that as well. One big part of their budget is the newborn screening program. They test newborns for 50 different types of congenital diseases that could, if they go undetected, could result in serious lifelong health problems or death. Last year, they tested about 70,000 babies born in the state. They also, the infectious disease lab looked at about 44,000 tests to monitor for infectious diseases, and looked at about 41,000 samples of potential chemical contaminants in the water, air, and soil. The last one is Office of Emergency Preparedness. Their budget is $30 million. As you can see, 99% of it's federal. The other 1% is general fund. These are the folks who, as I said, respond when there's a public health emergency. They also train and increase the capacity of our healthcare system to respond when there's public health emergencies and work to develop plans to respond when there is an emergency. And that's it.
Well, thank you very much. It was a good conversation. Any further questions for the commissioner, Mr. Greenman? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much. I've heard you mentioned the fungal meningitis as kind of a new. Is that the kind of the more later wave of or issue? Or I've got a couple appointments in my office on the topic of somebody wanting to know more about fungal meningitis. You mentioned it now. Just curious to know if you might address it.
Senator Lurie, and Mr. Chair, and Senator Kiffmeyer, the fungal meningitis that we've been doing is the response to the contaminated medication that came out of the New England Compounding Center, where contamination in a vial of methylprednisolone, a steroid, had been injected into individuals. We did a survey when it was identified, the first cases, there was a national alert. We worked with the pain clinics here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota and contacted about over 900 people, close to 1,000 people that had been injected with this contaminated, potentially contaminated medication. We followed up with them. We had 12 cases that were identified, and this was part of our disease monitoring and follow-up with that. So that's the fungal meningitis. We have had no deaths in Minnesota related to that, but there have been, I believe, 37 deaths nationwide with this fungal meningitis.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Ellinger, I'm interested in the wastewater treatment monitoring, and specifically thinking about the presence of prescription drugs in our wastewater. Is there some monitoring of that? Is there any special handling of that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, we certainly work with pollution control on the monitoring of those and prescription drugs, you know, into the sewer system is a big issue. So we do that in collaboration with PCA, but that is a PCA issue, I believe. And I'll follow up for sure and get back to you. Our role in this would be, a lot of this would be education about how to dispose of the medications that come through the medical system.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I've seen the material that comes home with high school kids on getting rid of drugs. My daughter was studying it and looking at it very, very carefully just last week, so that was good to see. seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Commissioner Ellinger, Dave Greenman. And we will start with the health-related licensing boards. We'll start with the Behavioral Health and Therapy. I believe that the Executive Director, Carrie Reitschel, apologies if I've just butchered your name, but please state it for the record.
Oops. Excuse me. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll help you out with my name. It's Carrie Rexigal, and it sounds a little bit like bicycle.
Okay.
And I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. And before I provide specific information about the board, I have some general comments to make about all the health licensing boards.
Great.
And by doing so, I hope to save the committee some time by avoiding duplication testimony.
I see that's the first kind of pages in the handout members that's should just be receiving.
That's correct. Pages 1 through 7, I believe, of the materials. So the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy is one of 15 boards that regulate licensed health professionals in Minnesota. And the health licensing boards are co-located in the same office building and collectively fund the administrative services unit, which we call ASU. And the ASU provides, among other things, purchasing, accounting, and human resources services for all the boards. And in a couple of minutes, Ms. Julie Vangsness, the manager of the ASU, will provide the committee with more specific information about the board's fees, funding, and budgets. And as I said, and as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, those pages are pages 1 through 7. You've also been provided with summary information from each board outlining the mission, purpose, regulatory strategies, funding, number of regulated persons, complaints, staffing levels, et cetera. And those summaries begin on page 8 with the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. I'd like to stress that the health licensing boards are regulatory boards. We don't just issue licenses and renew licenses. And the boards share many common features. Each board is an independent state agency. Board members, both professional members and public members, are appointed by the governor. And as you listen to our presentations today, please also note that our boards are state agencies created by the legislature to protect the public. We regulate the professions. We do not advocate for them. The professions are ably represented by their professional associations. Although we often work together on issues, we have distinctly different missions. Each board is funded through licensure and other fees that are deposited in the state government special revenue fund. The boards receive no general fund dollars. Again, the boards exist to protect the public in Minnesota by licensing only individuals who meet the requirements for licensure. The boards further ensure public protection by monitoring renewal and continuing education requirements. But most importantly, the boards take disciplinary or corrective action against practitioners who engage in unethical, unprofessional, unsafe, or incompetent practice. The boards also refer regulated individuals to the Health Professional Services Program, HPSP is for short, if their ability to practice with reasonable skill and safety is impaired by illness. And illnesses may include chemical dependence, physical problems, or mental health issues. And you will hear more about the HPSP, I believe, during the Board of Dentistry presentation. Finally, all the health boards participated in a sunset review process, which began in the fall of 2011. And each of the boards was subject to intense scrutiny of every aspect of their operations. And your handouts contain information about the sunset review and that summary is on page 2 and 3. Mr. Chair, if it's all right, before I talk about the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Ms. Vangsness to provide the committee with information related to the budgets.
Absolutely. Ms. Vangsness?
Thank you.
My name is Julie Vangsness, and I'm the accounting director for the health boards and also the supervisor of the administrative services unit. In general terms regarding the board's budgets and fundings and their fees, I'm going to just talk in general terms. And each of the boards have detailed information about their base budgets on their individual sheets that are in your packets. The boards receive a direct appropriation from the state governor's special revenue fund to cover all their operational costs, such as salaries, rent, board member per diems, travel reimbursement, supplies, and equipment. The boards cannot spend more money than what is appropriated within the biennium, and the appropriations can only be adjusted by the legislature. When the boards need additional spending authority, we would come back to the legislative committees to ask for that. Currently, our base budget amongst all of the boards is around $17 million. The boards also have other expenses that need to be covered by the fees that they collect, and that's expenses related to the Attorney General's Office, the Administrative Services Unit, the Health Professional Services Program, and at the Department of Health, the Infection Control Program that we do help fund. By law, the boards are required to collect sufficient revenues to cover all of their expenses, both the direct appropriation and the other expenses that I just mentioned. The boards deposit all their revenues into the state government special revenue fund, which are then credited to the health occupation licensing account. The boards monitor and review their income and expenses, and when revenues no longer are sufficient to cover those expenses, need to seek legislative permission to either increase or change the current fees. The fees can only be adjusted through the legislative process, and many of the boards haven't changed fees for several years. When revenues exceed the expenditures, they are maintained within the health occupation licensing account within the special revenue fund to be used by the boards. And these accumulative balances or reserves of the excess funding is then kept in an account that's used for unexpected expenditures related to maybe contested cases, disciplinary action, or to offset expenses in the future, or even delay the maybe possibility of a fee increase. In prior years, those reserves have been depleted by transferring funds from there to the general fund. And during the fiscal year 12 legislation, it provides new legislation that requires those funds to be used for the purposes that they were collected for through the boards and the programs that they administer. The Emergency Medical Services Board is also funded a little bit differently than the 15 boards that I just mentioned. They have a variety of sources of funding. They have general fund, dedicated fund, federal funds, and also fines from seatbelts. EMS receives a direct appropriation from the general fund to cover their operational costs and also to fund the regional grant programs. The board collects fees that are charged to the ambulance services, the licensees, the ambulance vehicle fees, the training program approvals, and some fines that for violations of statutes. Because the EMS system in Minnesota is heavily dependent on volunteers, particularly in rural areas, there are no fees charged to the certification of the EMS professionals. And that board collects roughly about $60,000 in revenue each year. The board, I did mention that the accumulative, their base budget is about $17 million. The other costs that we pay for the different other functions runs about $2 million a year, and all of that is deposited into the special revenue fund. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity, and if you have any questions, I'm available to ask.
Thank you. Any questions on the overview? Seeing none, we'll just move right into the testimony, I think. And then you did mention in that oversight that that just a couple of days ago we did receive the sunset reports. I haven't had a chance to pore over them yet, but we did make copies for members if they're interested in seeing those. We have several copies. We can distribute those. But the intent of this is just a broad overview and try to get a feel for who these individuals are and what they're trying to accomplish. And we can dig more into the sunset in more depth as we roll through the session and pick out pieces. But we can probably hand those out now, and people can just flip through them and get some first impressions. But with that, back to behavioral health and therapy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy was created in 2003. You may be the newest board. I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, the board regulates professional counselors and alcohol and drug counselors in the state of Minnesota. Professional counselors are master's-level mental health counselors employed in a variety of settings, and they provide mental health counseling services to Minnesota citizens. Alcohol and drug counselors provide counseling to persons seeking services to address chemical dependency, substance use, and abuse. The board has 13 members. 5 licensed professional counselors, 5 licensed alcohol and drug counselors, and 3 public members. The full board meets quarterly, and board committees meet on a monthly basis or as needed. Our most active committees are the Complaint Resolution Committee, Application and Licensure Committee, and Legislative Committee. Our board office is staffed by 4 full-time employees, the executive director, 2 licensing coordinators, and 1 administrative assistant. We regulate a total of 3,527 individuals with active licenses to practice. And the breakdown is as follows, 2,400 alcohol and drug counselors, 146 individuals who hold a temporary permit to practice alcohol and drug counseling, 528 licensed professional clinical counselors, and 453 licensed professional counselors. Our annual budget is $415,000, and this budget is largely devoted to staff salaries, office rent, supplies, and equipment. I just want to highlight what I consider our top 3 accomplishments in the last biennium. My favorite one is that we retired the program debts for both alcohol and drug counselors and professional counselors in 2012. And for the first time since the board was created, we have a positive balance in the state government special revenue fund. Also in the last biennium, we invested in a licensure and regulatory database, and we now offer online services, including online license renewals and official license verifications. And our database also allows the board to better manage complaints and compliance with public disciplinary orders. Finally, in the 2012 session, legislation was passed creating a new chapter, 148F, related to the regulation of alcohol and drug counselors. The rewrite of these regulations for LADCs took 5 years, but the new law has replaced confusing, obsolete, repetitive, unnecessary language that was formerly contained in Chapter 148C and also in Minnesota Rules, Chapter 4747. That concludes my comments, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk about Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rexigel.
Rexigel.
I'm getting closer, I think.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you. We'll go with the Marshall Schrag from the Board of Dentistry. And HPSP, rather.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Marshall Schrag. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and I appreciate the opportunity to present a little overview of the board to you. The Board of Dentistry was established in 1885, though I haven't been there that whole time. It sometimes feels that way. Since 1885, the board's continued to strive to protect the public through the regulation of dental professionals. We regulate nearly 17,000 people across the state, including dentists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants. Among those that we now regulate, in addition, are dental therapists, the newest profession in dentistry, and the first state in the country to do so. Dental therapists represent a mid-level provider, again, which is a new concept in the United States, as well as regulating now a newly assigned responsibility as of January 1st of registering dental laboratories. So that's our first venture into regulating a business rather than an individual professional. Our board has 9 members, including 7 dental professionals and 2 public members. Although the professional members come to the board with their experience and expertise in dentistry, all members have the responsibility of representing the public. The board office is staffed by 10 full-time and 1 intermittent employee. Half of our employees are licensed dental professionals themselves. Our board members and staff are always ready to be a resource to you as you address issues that arise in our areas of expertise. We're a small agency, but we touch on the lives of nearly every Minnesotan, and we take that responsibility very seriously. As was indicated in the overview, the board's essentially provide one service, and that's regulating the health professions. In our case, that's made up of 3 components. Licensing, where we get involved with criteria for initial licensure, including participation in the Commission on Dental Accreditation for accrediting educational institutions, providing site visits and other input, involvement in examinations with regional clinical testing agencies, national testing for dental assistants, state jurisprudence exam, and a dental assistant registration or licensure exam for dental assistants in our state. We're also very interested in and promote continued competence throughout the career of our dental professionals, looking at CE as a broader scope of professional development, focusing on core competencies that that we require that dental professionals address. And then we do audits of those professional development portfolios. And then, unfortunately, but necessarily, we address a lot of our resources into complaints and discipline. We average 250 complaints a year. We're seeing increasing complexity, increasing utilization of the Office of Administrative Hearings to do contested cases and mediation to resolve cases. Again, that requires significant resources. Board members and staff are actively engaged with our colleagues regionally, nationally, and internationally, particularly with regard to clinical testing of candidates for licensure. The Board of Dentistry operates in an inclusive, transparent environment, reliant upon an active committee structure that invites the involvement of the public, as well as representatives from professional associations and educational institutions, all in an effort to remain relevant and current with changing technologies, science, and dental practice. As Ms. Rexigal indicated, the Board of Dentistry is also responsible as the administrating board for HPSP, the Health Professional Services Program. That is a shared program of all the health regulatory boards and the Department of Health. HPSP was established in 1994 to enhance public safety and health care through promoting early intervention, diagnosis, and treatment for health professionals and to provide monitoring services for potentially impaired providers. HPSP does these things to protect patients from risk of harm as an alternative to board discipline. HPSP operates under and on behalf of all the boards and the Department of Health through the oversight of the administrating board, the Board of Dentistry, and a program committee and an advisory committee. Health professionals through HPSP have an opportunity to self-report to maintain confidentiality while pursuing assistance in addressing their health impairment issues. The boards are able to rely on HPSP to be the experts in impairment issues, including concerns about alcohol, drug, physical, and mental health impairment, so that these protective services do not have to be duplicated across the boards. This program, along with the Administrative Services Unit, are prime examples of how the boards, as independent state agencies, are able to work together, where appropriate, to reduce costs while producing improved results. HPSP had 489 new cases in fiscal year 12 and had 615 cases open at the end of fiscal year 12. The caseloads for the case managers are high. Jointly, the board and the HPSP, the annual base budget is $1.82 million. The budget is primarily allocated to staff salaries, office rent, and supplies and equipment. We continually assess our operations to maximize efficiencies and effectiveness. We operate the board as a business with a great sense of responsibility for the monies with which we are entrusted. Thank you for your interest, your attention. I look forward to working with each of you in the session ahead. And if you have questions now, I can address those. Otherwise, we'll wait till the end.
Thank you, Mr. Shragg. And Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question regarding your fiscal numbers for different areas and the Board of Dentistry licenses. Excuse me. You have a number of 16 dental therapists. I understand that program is new. But
correct.
How, considering you have a larger number in the dentist and hygienist area, how many dental therapists are you expecting in the future?
Mr. Schreck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen. It's actually quite exciting to see the growth in that. The first contingent or cohort of graduates from the Metropolitan State University program and the University of Minnesota programs, the two dental therapy programs that are available in the state, graduated in 2011 and 12. Actually, tomorrow we'll be doing an exam on the first applicant for an advanced dental therapy certification. So those numbers are small now, but they will grow probably at the rate of 12 to 15 a year until we get to a critical mass. And but yes, it's a unique group, a group of pioneers in a new field, and so it's actually quite exciting to watch.
Thank you,
Senator Laurie.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you tell me what kind of subject matter might bring you to this committee in terms of finance issues as a Health and Human Services Finance Committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I appreciate the question. The issues that would bring us here are, number one, our board budget, to make sure that we have the resources appropriated to do the work that we need and to sustain the program that we have.
Mr. Chair, so what you're saying is that in order for you to raise fees or change your budget, that has to be run through this committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that's correct. And in fact, it was indicated before by Ms. Vagsness that we have our monies are reserved in the Special Revenue Fund. But we need the legislature, your committee, to actually appropriate the spending of those funds in order to be able to access them.
Senator
Sharon.
From my memory, once we've determined the parameters on that, do you have to come back every biennium, or is that allowed to continue until you need to make a change?
The fees are set up, and it's when you need to raise the fees, you return to the legislature to ask for additional.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that actually does vary by board, but yes, if we had to raise the fees, the fees are established in statute, so any change to the fee would have to go through the committee of the legislature. Our board has established in the past, and any new fees, I would anticipate that we would go forward the same way, is to establish a not-to-exceed amount so that the committee, the legislature, establishes a cap by which we cannot exceed, which allows us some flexibility in the event that we need to reduce fees or raise them within a range, which we actually did do in the last 2 years and took advantage of that opportunity. We don't anticipate raising our fees or coming back for that request for our board in the coming biennium. We reevaluate that each time we prepare a budget proposal.
And so in
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. In relationship to the Sunset Commission report here on criminal background check studies, just to orient me to our relationship to these boards,
okay.
That's what I'm looking at as much as the function, but the relationship that we have with you. You'll be coming forward with a bill that responds to the recommendations here on criminal background checks for all boards. It'll go through health policy. And then will the discussion about the way that that's paid for be coming through this committee?
Senator Sharon, yes. Discussion about how it's paid for
then
certainly
will come
would be.
Here. So there's changes in that that would require it to come through this committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, actually that's a good example that what I was addressing is our base budget and the allocation for the base budget. But when we come with a new bill or a proposal or respond to one that has a fiscal impact, the boards are responsible for producing a fiscal note that would come to the committee to address so that we could anticipate what it would cost to implement any new programs, and that would be on top of our base budget.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Marriages and Family Therapy. Jennifer Molinoff. Welcome. State your name for the record in case I butchered that one too. But
good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Molinoff. So thumbs up, Mr. Chair. I'm the director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. We license marriage and family therapists, LMFTs. That's the independent license to practice. We also license associate marriage and family therapists, LAMFTs. These are individuals who've completed their education and some training, but must practice under supervision while they complete the rest of their practical education. Marriage and family therapists are mental health professionals who work throughout our healthcare system wherever mental health services are provided. So in our government social service agencies, our schools, hospitals, clinics, in-home therapy as well. Becoming a licensed marriage and family therapist takes several years. A graduate degree in MFT or a related field is required. An applicant must pass the national examination in marriage and family therapy, and then a minimum of 2 years of supervised practice is required, and then an applicant must finally pass an ethics and professional practice exam specific to the state of Minnesota. The board currently has over 2,200 individuals within its licensure system. We have approximately 1,600 LMFTs in Minnesota, a little over 300 LAMFTs, and approximately 250 to 300 applicants in our system at any one time. Over a 10-year period, 2001 to 2011, the number of licensees and applicants in our system has doubled. We have a board of 7 members, all appointed by the governor. We have 4 licensed professional members of our board. We have 1 member who's also a licensed marriage and family therapist, but is specifically appointed to represent higher education and the graduate MFT programs. And then we have 2 public members. We staff several committees, our complaints, applications, and then our state examination committees meet monthly. Our board meets 6 times a year. We are a small board in terms of funding for staff. We operate with funding for 1.6 full-time employees in the board. We collaborate with all of the other health regulatory boards, as you've already heard. We utilize the services of the Administrative Services Unit, ASU, which are vital to the operation of all of the boards, but particularly a small licensing board. Very, very important. We also work very closely with the other boards that are perhaps categorized as small boards, so we don't necessarily share a practice similarity, but we are all boards that operate with small staff, and we also share database and technology platforms with these other small boards. We are always looking for new and collaborative ways to maximize the use of technology to better serve our licensees and the citizens of Minnesota. Our board has online license renewal, online license verification, and obviously a web presence where forms, information, and instructions are always available. We are looking to add online continuing education program approval and online applications in the future. It is apparent that use of technology is the primary way that our board in particular will continue to improve its efficiencies in fulfilling its statutory responsibilities. Overall, running a small regulatory board has its unique challenges, but we are fortunate to operate in a strong and collaborative framework. And within that framework, we strive to utilize our resources as efficiently and effectively as possible to serve both our licensees and the members of the public with whom we're charged to protect. So with that, I'll be aware of the committee's time and if there are any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Mullenhoff. On to the Board of Medical Practice, Mr. Leach. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about our board. We are the agency that's responsible for the regulation of physicians and 6 other healthcare professions: acupuncturists, athletic trainers, respiratory therapists, physician assistants. We used to have physical therapists. I'm so used to saying it. Traditional midwives, and finally, naturopathic doctors. We fulfill our mission to protect the public primarily in 2 ways. First, through our licensure process, we ensure that anyone who is granted a credential to practice in Minnesota meets all the minimum entrance to practice standards that are set forth in the laws. Secondly, through our complaint review and disciplinary process, we ensure that anyone who holds a credential to practice continues to practice with reasonable skill and safety to their patients. The board is comprised of 16 board members. There are 11 physician members and 5 public board members, all appointed by the governor. Because no members of the allied health professions that we regulate hold a seat on the board, we utilize advisory councils made up of those healthcare professionals and others to advise the board in its credentialing and disciplinary decision-making. The board conducts operations primarily by its standing committees. Because of the volume of complaints we receive every year, we have 2 standing complaint review committees, which meet monthly. We have a licensure committee, which meets bi-monthly, and a public policy and planning committee, which meets quarterly. The full board conducts 6 full board meetings per year, regular scheduled board meetings, with the other 6 months set aside for anticipated contested case activities. The board is assisted in its operations by a staff of 21 employees and by the legal and investigative services of the Office of the Attorney General. We also contract with 5 physicians to work with us on a part-time basis. They each give us about a half day a week to come in and serve as medical coordinators for the purpose of advising board staff and board committees on medical matters. Because of the wide variety of medical specialties that come before the board in its disciplinary process, it's necessary for the board to enter into contracts with outside consultants to provide them with expert opinions on these medical matters. We currently regulate approximately 27,000 healthcare professionals, and we issue about 5,000 new credentials each year. The board receives and processes between 800 and 900 complaints regarding its credentialed professionals annually. Like the other health licensing boards, the Board of Medical Practice receives no general fund dollars and are funded entirely by the fees we collect from the individuals that we regulate. For the next biennium, we are anticipating a base budget of $4,509,000 for each of the 2 fiscal years. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's all I have. I'll stand for any questions that you might have of me.
Thank you, Mr. Leach. Any questions of members? Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Leach, I want to tell you my thanks for the problem that we had about 3 years ago, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, where we had a person that needed to be licensed in Minnesota that did have to go through a rather lengthy procedure. And I'm wondering, at that time we were talking about the examination being changed nationwide. Can you give me a status on that? Is that still happening? There's a lot of medical professionals that may be in that same situation where they have they've attended a college outside the U.S. and gotten their medical credentials outside the U.S. and wondering how they may be viewed on being licensed in Minnesota now.
Yes, Senator Cohen.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Cohen. What the Senator is referring to is the licensure standards that we have set forth in our Medical Practice Act. We have based on recommendations from the Federation of State Medical Boards. And these have to do with how many times an applicant can take steps 1, 2, and 3 of the United States Medical Licensure Examination, and also the time frame that you're looking at. And there are also other regulations that relate to foreign medical graduates. I believe what we were talking about before was either the number of, I think it was the number of steps that your constituent had a problem with. Is that not correct, as I recall?
There was a,
Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Lee, it was a number of times that the person had, was up. Degree that had been gotten in a foreign country, and then there was a number of failures of the examination, and Minnesota had a tighter standard than some other states did on the number of failures leading to licensure. And if I remember correctly, the number of failures in Minnesota even I think that a person can waive into Minnesota after getting a license in another state, but in this person's case could never be licensed within the state by taking the state license. But I believe the out was, and I think that was the recommendation, was to go to Canada and take the Canadian license, and okay. the Canadian license was reciprocal to the Minnesota license.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Mr. Leach.
Oftentimes we have applicants, particularly you see it a great deal with foreign medical graduates, who come to this country and are attempting to get a license in Minnesota and don't meet our legislative criteria for licensure. What we advise those individuals at that time is the easiest thing for them to do is not start the United States medical licensing examination sequence from step one, because step one is the most difficult. It's a basic science examination, which once you're out of medical school, you've forgotten everything that you've learned in basic sciences. So we tell them to go up to Canada, and there's a two-part examination to obtain Canadian licensure. And if they do obtain Canadian licensure, that satisfies our statutory requirement for licensure here in Minnesota.
Thank you.
And Senator Mr. Chair, Carlson. And Mr. Leach, there was that next step that we were going to go through in changing the U.S. Test sequence. Is there any progress on that?
Mr. Leach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, that wasn't our process. At the time we met, the Federation of State Medical Boards was involved in discussions to shrink the United States medical licensing examination from that dreaded step one, the basic sciences exam, and combine some of that step one information into step two. And so you'd basically, rather than have a three-part examination, it would become a two-part examination. To the best of my knowledge, the Federation is still studying that issue, although at our last annual meeting last April, there was no discussion on it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, it looks like Mr. Snyder is going to take up nursing home administration and optometry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Snyder, the executive director for the Board of Nursing Home Administrators and the Board of Optometry. Those are two separate independent agencies, and I share myself 50% and wear two hats on occasion. I also lead the Administrative Services Unit as the sponsoring administrative agency. Their budget falls under my jurisdiction as well. I'm editing as we're going here in the spirit of time management, and so I will get rid of most of my comments. The uniqueness for ASU, I do want to point out two things for you as a Senate committee. There's a program called the Voluntary Health Care Provider Program, and that was created in mid-2000s, 2005, Senator Cascaden from Rochester. Had a number of providers out there, dentists, physicians, who wanted to continue to provide services in a community-based program, volunteering, but did not want to pay their liability insurance. We pay for that, 63 individuals through Administrative Services Unit. It's a very good, important program, especially for communities of disparity. And so it's very effective. 63 physicians, dentists out there who are providing voluntary services. We pay their liability insurance through the Administrative Services Unit. And Julie did a great job of finding a good coverage for that as well in a group plan. So that is something unique. Also, the Council of Health Boards will review emerging professions. You get approached a lot of times from acupuncturists and dentistry who are looking at chiropractic. No, I don't know. There are a variety of new emerging occupations, and there's a rather extensive process that the Pew Commission put together, and we have done studies for you. Actually, it's the Policy Committee, more Senator Sharon, but that is a unique program that we've also performed in the past for you as a committee. In our work. So that's ASU. BNHA, the Board of Nursing Home Administrators, the uniqueness there is that we're the only federally required board. In order to receive Medicare and Medicaid monies, you must have this board. So I feel like I have the greatest job security there is, but that's a different issue. There are 11 board members. We include the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to coordinate all of our efforts so that we are not duplicating and that we are as streamlined as can be. We spend a lot of time with the emerging leaders. There are six Minnesota colleges that provide long-term care administration. University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and the University of South Dakota are a great resource for us, and we work with those. And even though our focus is just skilled nursing facilities, the curriculum is broad-based for all home and community-based services, assisted living. So we're looking at that future leadership for all of those three areas. Minnesota does not license assisted living administrators at the present time. Since it's his budget, there's not going to be an increase when the governor's budget is released. No increase in fees requested. We have no general fund dollars. We have not increased our fees since 1995. And so it is a flat budget that will be presented when the governor releases that for nursing home administrators. The Board of Optometry was the first board created in the United States back in 1901 for the Board of Optometry, and now all 50 states and all Canadian provinces are in the Association of Regulatory Boards for Optometry. Minnesota has the vice president on a national level. Dr. Roger Papps from Redwood Falls is the vice president of that national association. Minnesota does not have an optometry college, so there are 21 nationally approved colleges, and so we work very carefully with those colleges, those students, to assure that they have a streamlined process in order to come in to licensure in this state. We've worked very effectively on that so that there is not a barrier for them to come into Minnesota, and I believe that's working very effectively. We are looking at rewriting all the optometry statutes, and Senator Sharon, you will perhaps see us next year under policy committee, and the optometry board is looking at creating a total revision without controversy, if that can exist, and we'll be back next year for that. There are no fees increased expected for this board. It remains at $105. That has been there since 1995. We haven't increased for 17 years. And so it will be a flat budget that is presented in the governor's budget again this year. And with that, I will stand for questions and appreciate your work in this great state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Snyder. Questions? Mm-hmm. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schmick?
Snyder.
Snyder, I'm sorry. Just a couple questions on the Nursing Home Administrator Board. You mentioned at this time there is no requirement for assisted living. Are you looking at that?
I'm sorry, what?
Mr. Snyder, is there a requirement for assisted living facilities administrators? Are you looking at that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, Minnesota is one of only three states that does not have that. The associations are not particularly in favor of that. Our board has been somewhat quiet. We have been looking at that. We've had some associations lobbying for elder care that have looked at it, but it has not actually come up as an issue that has been put to the front burner on our board. It continues to be there, and it's there, but it's not ever been advanced by any particular group.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume there has to be a pretty good reason for to go down that direction. And I would assume if you're going that direction, you'd have to have a good reason. My next question is, in your curriculum for the nursing home administrators, how much attention is brought to the business side of it, running a business, a facility, a long-term care facility as a business? Do they get – is it more on the care side?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, no, about leadership and management is about 35% of the curriculum that's specific just to the leadership. Consensus management is huge, and how do you get all these players to work together? The fiscal side is another 17% of the focus study on that. Human resources is a 22% portion of that pie. Actual resident care in the clinical part, we expect our wonderful nurses to be able to handle that. That's about 33% of the whole educational piece that's out there. So it's a broad curriculum. It is far more intense what should be provided. Probably should be a master's doctorate level than what can be provided in a four-year baccalaureate program. So it is well-rounded for leadership and management as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Talking with my nursing home administrators, they believe there should be a push more on the business side of running this facility in a business manner. Than and they don't have that support until they have so many
years behind them, and then they understand how critical that portion of their education has been lacking. So I'm just, and I serve, I think I'm up to 17 nursing homes, and I'm not sure how many assisted living centers. But.
So they're, Senator Rosen, if I'm understanding you correctly, they think that the curriculum needs to be changed?
They
so
believe that, there
so
was
that it has a larger focus on the business aspects of running a facility?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, they wish there was more a business push on their on that curriculum.
Okay. I guess, yeah, this is – these are – Minnesota standards or national standards, or where do these come from?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, both. There's a national examination and Minnesota standards. We have a curriculum of 8 courses that are required. And to your question, Senator Rosen, we have 2 board members from your area. So I would love if those administrators would talk to those board members, and we'll be happy to look at the curriculum. We look at that all the time. We are going to start another 4-year strategic plan at our next board meeting next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So this is a perfect opportune time, and we do look at those. Our practicum is the other issue that is a little light. It's only 400 hours. It probably needs to be more, that actual field experience of mm-hmm. learning what it is behind the desk and to learn the business aspect. So mm-hmm. it's a perfect time to bring that up, and I encourage you. It's a good board. They're good people that want to do what's best. So have them talk either to board members or to myself. I'll be happy to address that.
Thank you, Mr.
Snyder. We have several to go and 25 minutes or 23 minutes, something before session, so we probably better move on to Cody Weiberg with the Board of Pharmacy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And I'll give just a brief view of the Board of Pharmacy today, and mindful of the committee's time, you may not have time to do this, but listening to the testimony of Commissioner Ehlinger, I know that Senator Kiffmeyer had questions about fungal meningitis that was related to pharmacy that compounded. I can answer questions about that here or at a later time.
And probably offline at a later time would be
right.
mm-hmm. better so that
sure.
we can get through.
Just to let him know, and Senator Carlson had questions about pharmaceutical waste, and we've done a lot of work with the Pollution Control Agency about that as well. So the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, like the Board of Dentistry, has been in existence since 1885. Our mission is to protect the public from essentially tainted drugs, adulterated drugs, from misbranded or mislabeled drugs, to regulate the practice of pharmacy. We also get involved in just about any issue related to drugs, frankly. Back in the 1970s, the legislature designated the Board of Pharmacy as being the state agency that schedules controlled substances. So we even get involved in the use of street drugs, and we did a lot of work last couple years, on synthetic designer drugs, which is actually, I think, the purview of the Public Safety Committee, but it has public health health implications as well. We address these key issues then, the safe distribution and use of human and veterinary prescription drugs, abuse of prescription and illicit drugs, and pharmaceutical waste. Our priorities are to prevent disease and death that can be associated with the improper use of human prescription drugs, to prevent the improper use of veterinary prescription drugs so they don't get into the food supply and have an adverse impact on humans. We work a lot with the Board of Veterinary Medicine on that issue. To prevent the abuse of prescription and illicit drugs, and to help reduce the production and improper disposal of hazardous pharmaceutical waste. We obviously serve the citizens of the state primarily. That is our focus, as was mentioned earlier. We don't represent the profession of pharmacy. We don't advocate for the profession. We achieve our goals by working on issuing licenses and registrations to pharmacists, pharmacies, pharmacy technicians, pharmacy interns, and like the Board of Dentistry, but more extensively, we do license businesses, which is one thing that does set us apart from most of the other boards. We license, as I mentioned, pharmacies, drug wholesalers, drug manufacturers, controlled substance research facilities, medical gases, even. We regulate those as well. In addition to issuing the license and registrations and making sure the licensees and registrants meet the requirements for licensure and registration, as do all the boards, we receive and investigate complaints from the public and take disciplinary action when necessary. Unlike most of the other boards, we do have six pharmacists on staff that are formerly known as surveyors, more commonly called inspectors. We do inspect all of the licensed facilities that are located within the state of Minnesota. We also operate the Minnesota Prescription Monitoring Program, which is a relatively new program that tracks all the controlled substance prescriptions that are dispensed to residents of the state. And the goal of the Prescription Monitoring Program is to provide a tool to prescribers and pharmacists so that they can detect people who might be engaged in what's called doctor shopping, which is receiving prescriptions from multiple prescribers and having them filled in multiple pharmacies. Sometimes, unfortunately, they abuse the drugs themselves, but we're also aware in our work with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that there are actually organized rings of people who do this and sell the drugs on the street. And prescription drug abuse is an epidemic in the country and state. And again, we work with the Pollution Control Agency extensively, and we've worked with law enforcement agencies around the state on ways to have take-back programs so that pharmaceuticals can be taken back and actually prevented from ever getting into the waste stream in the first place, or actually getting into the waste stream appropriately, which is sending them to incinerators. And with that, I will take any questions, or again, I'd offer an invitation to any of the members, any of your staff. If you get a question that has the word drug, pharmacy, prescription, pharmaceutical, anything like that in it, probably we're somehow involved.
Mr. Weiberg, I know Senator Kiffmeyer had the issues about the fungal meningitis, and Senator Carlson was very interested in the disposal. Senator Rosen and I have had extensive discussions on the prescription drug abuse. You know, methadone has been a huge issue in my region, and there's going to be a lot of attention on that and trying to get to the right regulatory environment to make sure that pharmacists and are in charge of the science and whatnot, but that the regulatory environment works to try to prevent the misuse and diversion of these agents. But with that, I think we'll take most of these questions offline and probably move
on.
My
question is only financial, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
That's all, if that's okay. It has to do
with Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah. Financial, but in one of the reports, Sunset Commission report on fees under the Board of Pharmacy, there's a very big jump in 2013 on expenditures, and it goes down a little bit, but not back to the previous. You can tell me more about this later if you like, but since we're a finance committee and the attention to this board, I thought it might be appropriate for you
Mr.
to
Weiberg.
Comment
Mr.
To
Chair,
that.
Senator Kiffmeyer, our expenditures have actually steadily gone up over the last several biennia. Some of that has to do with the prescription monitoring program I mentioned. That was a pretty much brand new program in it was implemented in 2010. We actually used federal grant money to design the program and implement it. I'd have to double check, but I believe it was in the 2010 or 2011 session. I think it was 2010 where we finally found a mechanism to fund it with state dollars. And so a lot of it is that. We did have a fee increase. We hadn't had one in about a decade. The purpose of the fee increase was to replace a pharmacy inspector who had retired in 2009 and who we did not have the finances to replace. So that accounts for another big jump in the spending, actually. And I can certainly discuss that more often with you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg.
Extensively with you.
Senator Carlson. Clausen, I'm sorry, yes.
I believe a few years ago the state passed a statute which allows electronic distribution of drugs, which eliminates pharmacies. Can you tell me a little bit about, one, how is that working and the implications that it has on your organization?
Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen.
Yes.
I'm not aware that the state has passed any legislation that allows for anything that would eliminate pharmacies. I think pharmacies are here to stay for a long time. The state did pass legislation either last session, I think it was last session, to allow the electronic prescribing of controlled substances, which was not allowed by the federal government for a long time, but now is, so that conformed with federal law. You may be thinking of there are a variety of mechanisms now where a portion of drug distribution that used to happen in pharmacies can now happen in other locations, and there is a electronic link back to the pharmacy, but the pharmacies are still involved. Specifically, what a piece of legislation that was passed last year, and this is really because of an action of Congress, is kind of the wave of the future. Congress passed legislation several years ago that limits payments for Medicaid and Medicare in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities unless they make efforts to reduce waste. They can do that one of two different ways. They can either prepare the drug in pharmacies but in smaller supplies, and normally pharmacies traditionally have sent a month's supply at a time. The problem with that is if somebody passes away, unfortunately, a lot of that drug is wasted. So they can send it in maybe two-week supplies, which involves a lot of extra work and expense for the pharmacies. The other thing Congress allows to happen is the use of what are called automated drug distribution systems right in the nursing home. And in this case, the drugs are actually packaged in the nursing home as they're needed, each shift sometimes. The pharmacy still has to be involved, though, because there has to be a central service pharmacy. Every order has to be reviewed by a pharmacist before it's released from the machine. The pharmacy has to package the drugs and canisters that go out to the machine. This probably will have an impact on independent rural pharmacies that do nursing home business right now, which I think many of the board members think is unfortunate. But because of what Congress has done, I think there's going to be pressure to use this sort of automated system.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. And these are issues that will be picked up in Senator Sharon's policy committee and passed on to us. I think in the interest of time, we're going to ask the next presenters to really focus on financing and give a quick overview, and apologies to those of you who have sat here for a long time. And we're also going to call up a couple at a time. So physical therapy, podiatry, and dietetics and nutrition with Stephanie Lunning and Ruth Grendel. Could come up together, and welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Stephanie Lunning. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Physical Therapy. We're one of the small boards that Jennifer Molenhoff referenced. We are an independent agency. Since 1999, the Board of Medical Practice did regulate physical therapists from 1951 to 1999. 11-member board, including three public members, one physician, five physical therapists, and two physical therapist assistants. In 2000, when the board was first appointed, they were sort of informally told by another staff member at another agency that they would never be able to do all they needed to do with the $60 annual fee. And I think this board took that on as a challenge, and they are absolutely committed to being fiscally responsible. That $60 fee was established in 1994. We are still operating with that $60 fee, fully funding all our board operations. And they they review their budget very, very closely and are even able to be the only board that pays the 10% surcharge to Office of Enterprise Technology Minute on behalf of their licensees. So very fiscally responsible board and operating within the existing revenues coming in and growing technology and growing services, dealing with increasingly complex discipline cases. Number of licensees has doubled in the last 10 years. So our finances are in good shape. And
great. Thank you very much, Ms. Lenning. Ms. Grendel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Ruth Grendel, and for 3.5 years I've served as the Executive Director of the Board of Podiatric Medicine, which was founded in 1917. And we have not raised our fees since 1999. I am the half-time executive director, the only position there. We have 229 podiatrists, which was a 5% increase last year. And we're starting to see this trend due to the aging population in Minnesota. So we expect this to continue. A month ago, I was hired as the half-time executive director of the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice. It was created in 1995. It has reduced its fees 3 times since the inception. There is a 0.8 staff, so it's me at 0.5 and an office administrative support at 0.3. Both boards are 100% fee funded, and neither board is looking at a fee increase this year.
Thank you very much. That certainly was succinct. Any questions of either Ms. Lenning or Ms. Grendel? Seeing none, thank you very much. We'll call up the Board of Psychology and the Board of Social Work, Angela Barnes and Kate Zacher-Pate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leo Kempera. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Board of Psychology. Mrs. Barnes could not be here today.
Welcome.
And in the best interest of time, I'll try to be brief.
Could you repeat your name? I'm not sure we got that.
Yes, Leo Kempero, C-A-M-P-E-R-O.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. The Minnesota Board of Psychology protects the public through licensure, regulation, and education to promote access to safe, competent, and ethical psychological services. The board is composed of 11 board members. 8 of them are professionals in the practice of psychology. 3 of them are public members. And we operate with 9.5 staff. And we have about 3,767 licensees in the state of Minnesota. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Comparos. Ms. Zacher-Pate?
Yes, good morning, Senator Lurie and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here. And I will try very hard to compress my comments. The Board of Social Work was created in 1987 by the legislature. We have 4 distinct social work licenses in Minnesota. There's a bachelor's license, a new graduate license. We have 2 independent licenses, which are an advanced generalist, non-clinical, and a clinical license. So that gives you a little bit of context of who we deal with as a profession. In terms of finances, one piece of information that I want to be clear about, with our board structure, we have 15 board members, 10 professional members, 5 public members, and we have actually quantified their volunteer service. And what we discovered when we did this was for the calendar year 2010, and our board members are contributing on average about 1,300 hours of volunteer service for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And when we tried to attach a dollar value to that, you know, at perhaps a going contractual rate for a professional subject matter expert, we came up with the board contributing approximately $130,000 to the state of Minnesota. So we thought that that was quite a tribute to them. The Board of Social Work is comprised of 10.6 staff members, and then based on our number of licensees, our ratio is 1 staff person to over 1,200 licensees that we provide service to. Our budget and our fees, we are at a base budget for the next 2 fiscal years of $1,054,000. The board is, as you've heard, fee-supported, no general fund dollars. The board is very proud that we have been successful in reducing our fees by 30% since 2006, and we have been able to manage our budget. Our licensing fees, just as point of information, for our 4 licenses range from $3.37 per month for a professional bachelor's level license to $9.93 per month for our independent clinical license. So our licensing fees, we think, are very affordable and very manageable. What else can I tell you quickly? In terms of financing, the board has really adopted a mission-driven financial management approach. We've really adopted a cost of doing business, and the board holds themselves accountable to their budget. Lastly, I will just let you know as well, in terms of how policy and budget interface and needing to be able to operate a board effectively, as you've heard from other executive directors, our numbers, too, are increasing over the last decade. Our new licenses that we have issued have been up 25%. The number of current licenses over the last decade that we need to manage for these professionals are up 11%. In terms of complaints, we are also up. We were on average at approximately 134 per year. And last year in fiscal 12, our complaints are up to 174. So approximately a 40% increase. So we are really needing to manage a lot of increases in terms of the profession with our budget. And so far, we are doing a very good job of that. The board is very interested in collaboration. We work with stakeholders, with the public, utilize online services. I had other things I wanted to inform you about, but at this point I would close my comments. The board is really committed to serving the citizens of Minnesota. I would take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions? Thank you very much.
I won't ask a question, but I just would ask, I'd be very interested in what, and not for a response now, but if you could send to us some information about what you're seeing is the reason for the increase in the complaints.
Ms. Acker-Pate, we'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank
and
you
sorry
much.
We are running short on
That's
time.
That's all right. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Let me make the announcements because I know we have session starting in just a couple of minutes, and we'll invite the Board of Veterinary Science and the EMSRB, John King and Pam Bilodeau, up to the table. But let me make a few announcements in case members need to leave. We are not meeting next Monday. It is Martin Luther King Day. We don't anticipate meeting next Tuesday either. That is the release of the governor's budget, and I think we'll all need a minute to absorb it. We plan on meeting next Wednesday to start going over that budget if all goes well. So that should be here in room 123 with the caveat about, you know, 123 and 107. Pay close attention, and the staff will make sure that they get the notice out properly. So have your staff watch and direct you to the right location. So with that, John King, welcome to the committee.
Senator Lori, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me the brief time to speak to you today. I'm Dr. John King. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. Board of Veterinary Medicine was originated in 1883, which was before the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Dentistry, and that shows that people are more concerned about their animals than their teeth or their Tylenol. The summary sheet is in your packet. I'll stick to financial matters as much as possible. The majority, although we're called a health licensing board, the majority of our resources and finances are spent on regulation, not licensing. And that's something that needs to be reiterated always. It's not, here's your license, see you later. It's a lot of interaction and regulatory oversight with licensees from before they even submit their first application all the way through until they retire or die. The board is run with two FTEs. We are try to work very efficiently, and we embrace electronic government services when we are allowed and able to do that. The thing that financially, what I want you to take away from all this testimony today from everyone is that the special revenue funded boards are different than the general revenue funded boards. And the people that testified before you should be viewed as entrepreneurs and business leaders. We behave like a nonprofit organization. We are legally responsible for to collect the money that we that you allow us to spend. We are motivated to be efficient, and there are lots of opportunities that have been taken through initiatives with this group of individuals to collaborate and gain efficiencies for our own betterment and better protection of the public throughout Minnesota. And viewing it as a nonprofit accountable to a board of directors made up of citizens of Minnesota and looking at it in a business aspect differentiates special revenue funded boards from a general revenue funded agency. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. Sorry for the brevity.
Thank you, Mr. King. My apologies as well. Ms. Bilodeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak with you today, and I will also keep this as brief as possible and focus on the financial. Part of the context to better understand our budget will need to be prefaced first. I believe the EMSRB, first of all, was established by the Minnesota Legislature in 1995 and began operations in 1996. It's a relatively young profession, starting around the 70s, and the complexity of the education that's required, the certification for pre-hospital care providers that service staff ambulances and provide care has increased greatly in complexity. We now have five different levels of certifications, everywhere from a 40-hour course all the way up to around 700-800 hours to a year-long program. And gone are the days where a funeral home operator would show up and take care of patients. So that's how much the complexity has increased in a relatively short period of time. We have a 19-member board, and there's strong representation from all professions. The EMSRB has touch points with almost every part of the healthcare system. We have 11 staff that carry out the responsibilities set forth by statutes, rules, and the decisions of the policies set forth by the board. Our authority comes from the legislature through Minnesota Statutes 144E and Rules 4690. One caveat that I like to point out that's important to understanding our budget, it's worth mentioning that 65% of EMS are provided by volunteers. And as part of our goal for the EMSRB is to protect the public, we also provide technical assistance in improving quality care and work with the ambulance services. A component of the goals involves working with licensees to resolve public safety issues when possible before they reach the level of going to our complaint review panel or needing action by the board as a regulatory agency. As such, a good portion of our specialist time out in the field when they conduct inspections, investigations is, or inspections, I should say, is related to technical assistance. We are general funded because of the volunteer basis and aspect of our profession. Out of our budget of $5,189,000 and $758, out of that, only a smaller portion goes to operations, and that is $1,262,997. So the majority of it goes outstate, greater Minnesota, and some in the metro area to support those efforts. To give it some perspective of who we serve and the needs, we have 30,500 pre-hospital care personnel that we license, or certify, I should say, and register. We have 321 ambulance license. We inspect 846 ambulance vehicles.
We provide data to physicians to improve quality care, and that's about a half a million patient run reports a year. Grants, we manage 20, and education programs, there's 771 at this time in the state, and we also have a component of responding for emergency care, or excuse me, emergency events, and we respond to the State Emergency Operations Center, and last year we had 20 notifications and responded to about six events. With that, I thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and that concludes my overview. I stand for questions.
Ms. Bilodeau, thank you very much. Any brief questions? Seeing none, we stand adjourned and head up to the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.